So what grade would you give Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot? Hi, it's John Williams. Here come the Mincing Rascals. We're cool with Kim Fox expunging pot convictions, but the Rascals weren't so cool with Kim Fox. And in Trump land, wow, we start with the G7 in France. We end up in Greenland, accidentally dropping a nuclear bomb there instead of inside a hurricane. But that's later in this episode. Please rate this podcast and share it with your friends. To comment or advertise, just email John Williams at WGNradio.com. Good or bad, we really want this podcast to work for you, and your feedback is how we can do that. Oh, and did you know you can listen to this on Spotify at WGNradio.com, or just by saying to your smart speaker, I'll demonstrate here, play the Mincing Rascals podcast. Today is Wednesday. Yes, he said Wednesday. It's August 28th, 2019, and it's an early 9:32 in the morning for the Mincing Rascals. This is John Williams, and this is the Mincing Rascals, a podcast we record at the studios of WGN Radio. Listen for my little radio show weekdays from 1 to 3.
I'm Steve Bertrand. I host the Business Lunch on WGN Radio.
I'm Austin Berg. I'm content director at the Illinois Policy Institute and co-author of The New Chicago Way, Lessons from Other Big Cities.
I'm Eric Zorn, the very well-scrutinized columnist from the Tribune.
We will get to the scrutiny of columnists.
By the way, Austin, in plugs, we don't have time for subtitles, just the direct title.
Because here's what happens when
every book, it's a subtitle.
I know, and that's the most intriguing thing sometimes. The title is a splash, but then the subtitle really gives you where we're going to go. Eric, however, always gives us a subtitle that takes us to a place we're going to go later on.
I'm not a team player, is what he's saying.
What grade do you give Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot? At a press conference this week, activists gave her failing grades, Fs and Ds.
So when it comes to bringing democracy and transparency to our school district, we're giving Mayor Lightfoot a big fat F, and we're urging her to stick to the promises she made during that campaign.
After 100 days, they say she's failed to do the things she campaigned on. We asked our listeners, by the way, in a news click, a web poll question to grade her, and 70% gave her A's and B's. What do you give her, Steve Bertrand?
I refuse to play. It's 100 days, and I'm surprised she's playing. She has an event today touting her successes because she said earlier this week, she goes, well, it's kind of a Hallmark holiday. It doesn't really matter.
100 days.
And I would say that when you consider 100 days, you can tout accomplishments, but I don't think you should be responsible for failures. It's only 100 days, so I'm not going to give a grade.
How about you, Mr. Zorn?
Well, I mean, it's obviously tempting to give someone an incomplete, right? In this, you know, it is only 100 days, very arbitrary benchmark. I would say around B+, though, right now, because I am someone who falls into these traps very easily. I feel like she has, I like the way she stood up to the alderman and the ethics things that she's done. I feel like she has been active. She hasn't been wildly successful in reducing violence, but there has been a downtick in violence. I know she has not been able to follow through on some of her campaign promises. She was going to push for the real estate tax on expensive homes that would
cashless bonds
that would then fund homeless services, and now that money has to go to pensions. I understand that sometimes when you get into office, your campaign promises have to go out the window because when you realize what you're facing. One of the big reasons you'd give her an incomplete is she's got this speech tomorrow night, Thursday night, where she's going to have to lay out what she's going to do with this approximately $1 billion budget hole. And she's also facing a very difficult situation with the teachers union and the strike. And so those two challenges that are looming right now mean that this B+ is a very tentative grade right now. But I like the cut of her jib, as they say.
I think on ethics, you have to give her B+, A, very high marks on that category in particular. On everything else, I agree. She gets an I for either incomplete or impossible.
Really. It's impossible. That's why I'm not running for mayor, man.
That's the capital I.
Totally. And I think the biggest weighted part of that grade is going to be what she does with the budget. And I'm thinking of this budget speech. And do you guys remember in the U.S. version of The Office where Michael Scott realizes that he can, what bankruptcy is? And he goes out into the office and says, I declare bankruptcy! And that's what I'm imagining. She is facing Chicago has more pension debt than 44 of the 50 states. And the biggest cost drivers in her budget are pensions and personnel. And both of those, as Eric said, she has her hands very tied on personnel. She said that there's a hiring freeze, which is a good start, but there's going to be have to be severe cuts if that's the only way she's going to balance the budget this year. And on pensions, the state refuses to move. And in the long term, this budget is only going to become sustainably balanced in the long term with some kind of pension.
Awesome. You say the state refuses to move. Actually, it's kind of the courts that refuse to move, right? I mean, the state has tried a few things, and every time the state even kind of hints at changing the pension structure, the courts whack them down. So
the state tried in 2011, and they got Tier 2 reforms through, and then everything else was struck down. And since 2011, they've been sitting on their hands. And there, other states have moved. I think at the Illinois Policy Institute, the solution that we've proposed is making a differentiation between benefits already earned and benefits going forward. And the courts have agreed with that in other states, and that's absolutely something that state lawmakers should be trying.
I ask this all the time when the budget issue comes up, the pension speed bump. It's not a speed bump, it's a wall. Do you think the recipients of pensions that are too generous for the state to have ever afforded should feel guilty about receiving more money than they should, than the state should have ever agreed to give them?
No.
I didn't say should they give it back. I think
should they feel guilty?
Well, if I were the recipient of that every day, I'd go, man, you know, Illinois and Chicago will never be able to dig themselves out of this because I'm getting a pretty sweet deal.
I don't think
we never should have got.
I don't know if they should feel guilty, but I just spoke in Champaign, and there are a lot of state workers there, obviously, with U of I. And two different people came up to me after the speech and said, those 3% COLAs, I don't really think that's fair. And I'm a recipient. Obviously, that's something's been promised to you, and that's, you know, but everybody there, pensioners read the news,
well,
and they realize
it.
How severe the problems are.
So maybe guilty is the wrong
workers.
Word. Maybe guilty is the wrong word, but I mean, at least should they acknowledge that they're the crux of the problem?
I think they should promise to stay in the state and not leave.
Yeah.
So at least they spend that money here.
That's an interesting point.
You didn't give your grade.
I would give her a B+ like you guys. I like the cut of her jib, like Eric said. I don't know what anybody's supposed to accomplish in 100 days. But I like her attitude. I like her no-nonsense demeanor. And really, she will forever... I'm going to give her a pass for a long time just by the way she handled her first city council meeting.
Well, slapping down Burke.
In Cranes, Greg Hines actually gave her a lower grade because she took on some of those stakeholders, and that she didn't try to bring them into her tent.
Right.
She right away, you know, talked about that clown and all of that.
She addresses this, and I've probably elsewhere, but also in today's front page story, Wednesday's front page story by Greg Pratt in the Tribune, that she talks about the criticism that she got. And on the day that Burke was indicted, there were some aldermen who came to her quietly and said, hey, you're being really a little bit hard on this guy. And she said, sort of, imagine this. Imagine the system that I'm walking into.
In a world.
I'm paraphrasing this. Yeah. But I'm walking in a system where a guy is indicted, and the other aldermen are kind of sidling up to me going, oh, don't be so hard on the guy.
But I think when it comes to budgeting, Chicago, in terms of its city council, there's maybe three people who can read a budget. And one of them is Scott Wagesbeck, and she has definitely elevated his profile, and I think that's to her credit. But you have to empower the city council to take on those big issues. You need to fund staff in their offices that can actually analyze a budget, that can actually analyze citywide policy versus aldermanic privilege, which she has taken on kind of in name, but hasn't really taken it on to the root. Aldermen are still voting on thousands of ordinances on this itty-bitty little stuff in their ward.
That's not codified anyway, right? I mean, aldermanic privilege doesn't exist in writing anywhere, if I'm not mistaken.
It's a gentleman's agreement.
It's just a practice.
Gentlemen and ladies.
Yes, exactly.
Gentlemen. Mr. Bertrand.
But the way to get rid of it would be to all of those decisions should not be made via ordinance. That's how you get rid of aldermanic privilege. You put it in city departments that should be making those decisions instead of politicians.
I want to talk about Cook County now, from the city of Chicago. Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox, along with a California-based nonprofit organization, detailed plans to expunge thousands of pot convictions in the county this week. And I don't know where you guys are in this, but I don't see much of a problem with how this thing is going. In some cases, they'll automatically be done by computer program. The people don't even have to do anything. If your conviction is related to some other crime, my understanding is that's not necessarily going to be expunged. There's some details to work out by January 1st, but it looks like they're handling it pretty well. All agreed on that? I mean, this was a good idea. She did run on it. They're going forward, right?
Yeah, I don't see the problem. As long as we're not talking about associated with other different kind of, you know, worse crimes, but as my understanding is, it is just related to crimes that would no longer be illegal.
So Every time I see her standing before microphones, though, it's hard for me to not think of her overall honesty and competence. Even when she's putting forward kind of a slam dunk idea, I look at her and I just kind of wonder. Her office's handling of that Jussie Smollett case is there for me all of the time. And now Dan Webb is taking his investigation into that case, he says, wherever it leads him. And one wonders if, as John Cass suggested in his column today in the Tribune, she'll take the fifth if she's called before a grand jury.
The news conference yesterday announcing the program devolved into talk about Jussie Smollett. So yeah, that's not going to go anywhere. It's not going to go anywhere fast.
It's not hanging over her head enough, though, to have changed her decision on this in particular. And I think that's probably effect of public opinion completely being on her side. But so at Illinois Policy Institute, we actually worked with LaShawn Ford initially to introduce a bill that would allow for these sealing and expungement for class four felonies and misdemeanors related to pot if they weren't related to a violent crime. And that language was incorporated into the marijuana legalization that we saw in Illinois. That gave state's attorneys a choice. They could either put the onus on the people who are convicted to apply, and then they're sort of the intake point, or they could do a blanket, everybody's off. And the news story started with, look, she's partnering with Code for America. And the news was like, Code for America, Code for America, like Silicon Valley, so cool, so cool. The real story is she chose this other path that was a blanket sealing and expungement, which personally I think is totally the right move, but is interesting that she would do when something is hanging over her head like that, that is obviously like a law and order issue. And Dave Chappelle in his new special talks about it. Have you guys seen this? He talks about the case. It's amazing. Everyone should watch this special. And he calls Jussie Smollett, a French actor, which I liked a lot.
He left the house at 2 a.m. It's minus 16 degrees. You're walking. You're walking. All right. And where were you going? Subway. Sandwiches?
He's essentially talking about how the black community knew he was lying the whole time and and were being silent and were supporting them in their supporting Jussie in their silence.
It doesn't, so just to bring it back to that issue, it doesn't surprise me that Kim Fox is all in on the kind of justice reform that she has been championing. I mean, for her to go back on this now would just further confuse the issue.
You're talking about the pot conviction?
I'm talking about the pot convictions. I'm saying, you know, one of the things that she's been talking about is not filling our jails with low-level offenders and getting people, you know, not crowding the jails, getting people out on bond.
Pot's good legal in a few months anyway.
And really focusing on the serious crime. And so if she were to backtrack on that to compensate for the perception that she was too weak on the Smollett case, that would just confuse the issue. She's all in on that. And what I see happening right now is there's like three or four candidates who are in this race to challenge her next March in the Democratic primary. And I can see those people splitting the vote and having her win the renomination at about 38% to 40%.
I think John's point, though, was that no matter what she says, I've cured cancer and I screwed up Jussie Smollett.
Yeah.
I mean, it's going to always be there no matter what she does.
Well, like Jussie Smollett, I sort of position this as in some ways as a Blagojevich kind of moment, is she's got to admit what happened here. She's got to say, okay, look, I made a mistake.
She's been very forthcoming.
Isn't it too late for that? Wouldn't that make it worse? Wouldn't that make it worse?
I don't think so. I think that it's still relatively early in the campaign cycle. This is not going to go away if she just keeps not refusing to answer. John Cass's column this morning is based on speculation that that former Judge O'Brien
quoted
on his podcast, John's podcast on this WGN Plus, that she was going to take the fifth. She's not going to take the fifth. That's just not going to happen. That would be like politically disastrous for her to do that. But she's got to answer these questions. And this story is not going to go away because the John Williams of the world, along with the rest of us on this panel, I'm assuming, can't forget about this every time we see her standing in front of the microphones. You think, what were you doing with Jussie Smollett? Come on.
Well, you're the one, though, that said maybe the math is in her favor. Maybe she doesn't need to apologize or do any sort of mea culpa because she'll probably win even with this stain. I hope not. I hope the numbers don't work out that way. I think she's compromised so thoroughly the integrity of that office that even if she's got good ideas and executes them going forward, that shadow is always there.
And her champion was Tony Preckwinkle, too, right?
Yeah.
And Preckwinkle is greatly diminished these days.
She was her chief of staff, yeah. And do we know the timeline for this investigation? I assume this is going to drag out well into the campaign season,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, right.
And it may be even designed that way.
How complicated is this, though? I know that
these two people always, they've really got to interview.
There are a few people. There are some people in Kim Fox's office. Who did she talk to? I like to see them talk to Tina Chen, the well-connected attorney. I'd like to see them talk to her top deputies, Maggots, I think is his name. And then I'd like to see them talk to some of the people in the Smollett camp to the extent that they can talk. And then to the brothers and figure out what happened. How long does this take? 2 months, 3 months?
What's the worst case scenario for her? When Sheila O'Brien said to John Cass, maybe she'd take the fifth, wouldn't that be interesting? The only reason would be to hide something. And I'm wondering, what would the there be, right? Would it be, I honestly don't know. I don't know the machinations of her office.
Well, I think that there would be this, she said she recused herself, and then she yet told her assistant to drop the charges.
Which we sort of know, well.
No, we don't know that
No,
she
we don't
did,
know yeah. that, but we know that she, they knew what she wanted to have done, right? I mean, isn't that the general understanding?
My thought is that what we're seeing here is that Kim Fox believed that letting Jussie Smollett go was on brand for her. It was on brand for her, and it was going to help her with her constituents because she was being merciful and balancing out. And I think it all would have worked if Smollett had pleaded guilty and paid the same $10,000 and walked down to the lobby in the Layton building and said, I was having a bad day, and that was a stupid thing to do, and I'm sorry. And we would not be talking about this.
Is that the consensus, that it was on brand for her?
I think she thought so.
Well, I think it is on brand for
her. And you have to remember what the tone was at the time that she was making those decisions. It was the biggest social media story that there was, and
right.
He was a pariah and a martyr. So a lot of her decisions would make sense in that context if she is.
I think she got caught up with a celebrity.
I agree.
But I think it is on brand for her. I mean, there was some quote from her, I believe. Tell me if I'm wrong. But I mean, he was charged with what, 78 felonies?
16, but close enough.
Okay, 16. He was charged with 16 felonies here.
Yeah.
He was overcharged. I mean, I think he was overcharged, and that is on brand for her.
And I think that there would happen in, just like we see in any kind of investigative report, there's a nugget. There's a meme that is three or four words. The one that's off the top of my head was the Pritzker toilets thing was like conspiracy to defraud. And the Republicans ran conspiracy, defraud, defraud, defraud taxpayers, defraud taxpayers. If there is a nugget like that that comes out publicly that her campaign, that her opponents can run, and I think that's a big deal.
Okay. Steve, I'm watching the clock. Can we
do
a little?
He'll just walk out when I'm ready.
Okay. Well, let's just segue.
In a huff.
Bertrand's getting ready for his radio show as we are recording this before 10 a.m., his radio newscast on WGM. This week's meeting in France of the seven of the world's industrialized nations. I don't think I'll ever look at the letter G in the same way again. At the last G7, President Trump left Canada a day early. He stayed this time, but skipped the climate conference. He argued to let Russia back in. And this could be a new feature for us. The lie of the week. The lie of the week,
the week,
I think. Well, I think every week we should just say, what's the one thing that you thought was, wow, that was the one? Was that the First Lady has gotten to know pretty well Kim Jong-un and thought highly of his country's chances for prosperity. It's the little lies, proven easily, that reveal how untrustworthy he is.
Well, it's the lies, the unnecessary lies.
Well,
that's where you spot a pathological liar, when they lie, when they have no need to lie.
This is so pathological. She's never met him. And then, he does have a press secretary, and by golly, they conjured up a patch for...
she feels like she knows him.
The president, and I think right. The explanation is even more fraudulent than the lie, because the explanation was that he frequently discusses the intimate details of policy with her. Who believes that?
To quote a recent backstep, why wouldn't he? Right? I mean, this is the same thing.
I believe Bill may have talked to Hillary about stuff like this. Maybe. Maybe Barack talked to Michelle. I could get my head around that. Donald Trump does not talk about North Korean policy or the inner workings of that.
Stop. Right there. Donald Trump does not talk about North Korean policy. You could end it right there.
With his wife. And that made her feel like she knew Kim Jong-un is preposterous.
Yeah, on the North Korea stuff, the lens I usually take on anything Trump says on North Korea is that of a real estate developer. And that's how he talks about it. And that was the presentation he gave to Kim Jong-un, was essentially, if I'm a real estate developer and I see one of those like three-bedroom houses that still exists on the lake, and you come up to them and you say, man, you're sitting on gold here. Imagine, the riches that I could bestow upon to you if you do XYZ. And he says, my wife likes this guy, and I'm sure Kim Jong-un is not opposed to Melania liking him in any way. So,
but they've never met.
Of course. That's ridiculous. But I think Kim Jong-un obviously knows what he's doing, that to signal something to
Kim
Jong-un.
Yeah, right. I think that's the point.
He did it with Putin when he said they got to know each other in the green room of 60 Minutes.
Yeah.
And Putin was in Russia on a satellite.
But his effusive flattery of Putin and Kim Jong-un particularly, I do think are his way of negotiating in public with them. If I butter them up enough, then they will come to the table. They might denuclearize.
One of the more honest things that he may have said was during the news conference this week when somebody said, one of the reporters said, well, wait a minute, one week Chairman Xi in China is a big enemy of the country, and the next week he's your best friend. Which is it? And he cut him off and said,
the back and forth and the changing statements from yourself, so that
it's the way I negotiate.
So my question is that a strategy? Is it a strategy to call President Xi an enemy one day and then say that relations are very good the next day?
It's,
and then, it's gone back.
It's the way I negotiate. It's done very well for me over the years.
He likes to keep these people off balance. I think that they probably are less off balance than just baffled.
He's used tabloids to negotiate things his entire life. And I don't think it's surprising when he does that with foreign dignitaries.
And it might work. That's the funny thing. I mean, I think we are all, even if you're the leader of a nation and you know millions of lives are at stake, I think we are all susceptible to some forms of flattery.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I have a better lie of the week. So.
Okay.
When he's talking.
Oh, it's working. Go ahead.
Well, one of the things.
Love
is
your
that,
column,
that
by
he,
the way.
He's got to have the trust of the people. When he says that he had phone calls with China, right? Normally, you'd believe the president of the United States. China denies that they had phone calls.
Yeah.
And normally, you'd say, well, that's the president of the United States. He's telling the truth. These Chinese are liars. Come on. Do you think he had a phone call with China?
No.
I don't think
so.
That's the kind of thing he lies about.
You think
about.
That's the lie
that's
of the week?
That's the lie of the week, because that's much more substantive, where he said the talks are back on because China called me. I said that on my show yesterday. I'm like, I never thought I'd be presented with choosing between the president of the United States lying or the Communist Party of China. But here we are. This is where we are right now.
Okay, I'll be his press secretary, and it's just like Melania knowing Kim Jong-un. Okay, so maybe he didn't exactly have a call with China, with whoever that was. But I'll bet somebody on his staff, in some form, communicated with somebody on their staff, and that's a call. It's sort of like when he said Barack Obama tapped his wires. They didn't really tap them, but they were knowledgeable of. So it's just speak, and you have to sort of read through it. I really do think in his mind, if he's not intentionally outright lying, he thinks that there's a boat of truth to those.
I think, there's always some plausible deniability there. Of course, there are the U.S. government is speaking with the Chinese government on a daily basis. A phone call, exactly. So, and you saw it, and it's the little stuff, as you've alluded to. And you also saw this in the same week he was sending out tweets about, I'm here with all the leaders, and we're talking about, man, can you believe this fake news back in the U.S. and all the things that they say?
Were saying that to him.
Exactly. That other leaders were saying that to Trump. And it reminded me of people who might post a selfie of themselves and they're laughing and they say having lots of fun with my friends. They're all having an awesome time, just out of frame. And of course that delegitimizes every other statement that you make.
And then there's this business where he is apparently determined to build some wall, that the fact that he hasn't built any wall yet, he's just repaired old fencing, is going to not going to play well with his base. So he's so determined to build wall by the time the election rolls around that he's willing to ignore environmental standards and seize property. And according to, I think, the Washington Post said that he has told people in his administration that if you break the law and seize land and get prosecuted for that, I will pardon you. This is, again, according, I think it's the Washington Post reporting this. So you've got someone who doesn't understand the way all this stuff is supposed to work, which is why I don't have this confidence in his negotiating ability.
I want to go back to the G7 in a second, but, you just made me think of the fact that two of the issues that were so high button, one of them was the wall. We aren't talking much about the wall these days. The other one was impeachment. Raja Krishnamurthy, the suburban Chicago Democratic congressman, came out this week and said he's behind impeachment proceedings. They should continue to go forward. Is it interesting to you that nobody's talking about either of those things? That to the degree those were actually helpful to Donald Trump, because he gets to play the victim or the champion of national security in both cases, they don't seem to be that important right now.
And I think there's only three Illinois Democratic Congress people left who have not called for impeachment. Is that right?
Or something like that.
Yeah,
so
10.
I still don't see the equity, say, to Raja in getting behind that. I don't know that that helps him or is a winning cause.
These are nuanced calls. What they're not saying, impeach him right now. We're going to vote to impeach him right now. They're saying, let's open an inquiry, which is a half step toward that. And it indicates an openness to it that may not play well among certain voters. Because the voters, every poll I've seen, the public doesn't want to go through.
Exactly.
That. And so to say, I want to start going through something the public doesn't want to go through is politically risky. I think you should do it myself. I think it's their job. I know it may not be politically popular, but that's their job.
This is the age old controversy we've been, this is the irresistible force meets the unmovable object on this podcast lately. Should they do it as representatives of the people and they actually believe in their hearts that we've had high crimes and misdemeanors, or should they not, because that means that this man might actually get reelected if these proceedings fail, and it sort of reinforces the idea that there was no crimes in the Trump administration and it's just Democrats being Democrats. It could actually work against their cause.
It will fail because there's no way in hell right now that the Senate is going to vote for it. So he will survive the attempt to oust him from office.
What do you think is the higher calling? Doing, impeaching him, but allowing him to maybe get reelected, or not impeaching him so that it'll force.
I think what they ought to do is open this inquiry. They should have all the hearings they need and then delay the vote. Because as soon as you vote to impeach and send it over to the Senate, then you start this process that you don't want to give him an acquittal before the election. And that's, I'm sure, what's in everybody's mind.
Okay.
I think that the drama of the hearings and the stuff that's going to come out, this stuff this week, we may finally see the guy's tax returns. Again, what is he so frantically doing trying to prevent us from looking at his
oligarchs helped sign some of his loans? That's the fear. That's the early reporting.
But back, John, I think you made a very good point about sort of the cost benefit analysis of impeachment, or at least talking about it, right? And I think what's interesting is the other issue you just talked about, the wall. There's probably a parallel conversation happening there on the right, because you can't build. There already is all this fencing. There already is a lot of this stuff built. And you can have Trump go down there and stand in front of a big wall and get the exact same effect as if you actually passed a massive package through Congress. That probably isn't going to happen. So what do they do? Trump seems to be taking the route of maybe even telling people he will pardon them if they seize land, which is shocking and should be offensive to anyone who believes in constitutional restraint. But it's the same thing where he's signaling to his base that, hey, guys, I'm trying my best here. I'm trying to get this wall going. And I assume that will happen for the next 12 months. He'll still talk about it.
Well, and he can gaslight with the best of them. He can't go down and stand in front of a wall that's been repaired and say, look what I'm doing here. And we've got... He'll say, we've built 300 miles of wall, and the news will say, no, you haven't. And he'll say, who are you going to believe, me or the fake news? And we're going to be caught in that vortex for the next, 15, 16 months.
Do you like the idea that Joe Biden's ratings have fallen to the same as Elizabeth Warren's?
There was a new poll out this morning that showed that his numbers were back up. There was that one poll that poll may have been an outlier. I've already expressed on this podcast my fears that Biden is not up to this job. He's up to the campaign. He keeps making these dumb mistakes. He said he was in Vermont the other day when he was actually in New Hampshire. I mean,
that's not a dumb mistake.
Out of context, I know they lie thick end to thin end, right? And they're but that is a one-off thing. But that is part of this entire litany of gaffes this guy makes. He doesn't seem to be quite, have all the sandwiches you need for a picnic, if I may.
Well, poor kids can be just as good as white kids sometimes.
I know. So that was the unfortunate soundbite we played
but
here
there,
last
there's
week.
There's so many. I mean, don't you agree, Austin, that there's so many of them that the accumulation of them, somebody is like, really? I mean,
I think that's baked into the pie for him.
Totally.
I think that...
He's kind of in a trick box, too, because you're going to think that over the course of this primary, his numbers can only go down. I think he started high.
38.
Right? So he was blowing away the field, and everybody has converged on, let's attack Biden. So if you would think, unless he comes out with this, incredible new story or this new campaign or something, that his numbers are going to go down a little bit. The problem with the campaign, obviously, is, well, we need to have him, hitting pavement, pressing the flesh, out here doing all these events. and inevitably
it's going to happen.
Something bad is happening.
His gaffes, I think, are commensurate with Donald Trump's half-truths. So that's just, of course, that's what happens when he's out there. He's Joe Biden. But is he intelligent enough, trustworthy enough, knowledgeable enough? Can he build a coalition?
And Warren's brand is the opposite, right? She's the person who is whip smart and has a plan for everything and is going to use the government to fix all of our problems. She rarely ever makes a gaffe.
She got 15,000 people, 12,000 in St. Paul a couple of weeks ago, and then 15,000 in some other state here. I mean, people are showing up for her. I don't know what to make of that, but I wonder if that's not telltale.
No, I think she's very likable, especially in her home district, which I went to college there, and she came to our door and would shake our hands, and you know, she's very likable in a personal context. But I still think Biden is by far the clear front runner, and I don't.
Just about every Democrat I talk to says they don't care that much in this field. They just want someone who can beat Trump. You know, I hate to be, you know, to suggest that Biden is sliding into, you know, senescence or something, but to the extent that he is like competent, people will vote for him. People will come out for him because he's a likable guy. But if he keeps making these mistakes that suggest to you that the gears are slipping, again, and I agree with Austin, from what I've seen, Elizabeth Warren, she seems to be getting a lot of traction. I have seen a little bit of slippage in Bernie Sanders, but those three seem to be the real top three right now.
I think it's very hard to argue, even with those gaffes, that he is not, would not be far and away the better candidate in swing states than those other two.
Poor Beto O'Rourke. You know, he was the flavor of the month for a while, and he doesn't get much traction now either. I think he's polling below Mayor Pete. You know, I think he's like 3%.
I think he's going to be in that new ESPN, like, nude issue. He's doing that for
the body issue.
Publicity. Well, the body issue. Yeah.
Well, that's funny because he's trying to do things that say, hey, I'm an average Joe, right? So he posted a video, or maybe it was on Instagram. I'm not exactly sure how he pushed it out, but it's of him cooking a couple of cheeseburgers the way he likes them. And I think that sort of backfired.
Which was with like a slice of cheese, right? It's not like
he had a little ground beef patties, and then he had these thick slices of cheese on there. Looked good. Then he put them on buttered English muffins, and then a couple of raw onions on there. Then 2 broccoli florets on the side.
Nothing says Texas like a broccoli florette.
and an buttered English muffin with, and I don't know if that's a good burger or not, but internet blew up on it.
Did Obama get crap for saying that he likes arugula, or asked for the price of arugula in Iowa or something like that?
These are the things that you have to do that are so silly, but that we actually do require politicians to do, to feign some sort of similarity to the rest of us, maybe because it's genuine, maybe because it's not. But we ask them to do that, and it's so important.
But didn't that rule book get thrown out with Trump? It seemed like Trump violated every rule of politics, and he still won. He has gold toilets in his condos. Well, and I just feel like people just said, we don't care about any of that anymore.
I think what people forget about his campaign was in the lead up, especially in the primary, every day in his rallies and then also on social media, he would speak directly. Someone would be taking a very poorly shot video at like a desk, and he would comment on the issue of that day. That's all he would do. And then their campaign would target that exactly to the voting segments that would respond to that message. And I think more than cheeseburgers, that's the playbook that a lot of candidates should be following.
Cinco de Mayo, remember that? I mean, is that an example of that, where he was standing there in a poorly shot? No, not exactly.
No, he was talking about, like, remember when that Starbucks cup thing was like everybody cared about for 5 seconds? He would go, he would feign anger, or maybe he was genuinely angry, I don't know, go straight to camera and say,
did you read about Starbucks? No more Merry Christmas on Starbucks. No more. I have one of the most successful Starbucks in Trump Tower. Maybe we should boycott Starbucks. I don't know. Seriously. I don't care.
And it was like a 15-second video, and it would go crazy every time. And he wiped the floor with every other Republican primary candidate with that.
I also think that his malaprops, his misspellings, his lack of knowledge, sometimes because he's a liar, sometimes because he doesn't know, works for him. Because I think a lot of people out there go, yeah, me too. I get stuff wrong. I don't care how you spell there. And my
if I had nuclear weapons, I would drop them on a hurricane. Speaking of which,
I love that story
that
this week.
That story would have been like all we were talking about all week in normal times, right? The president talked about dropping a nuclear bomb into a hurricane.
Do you have confirmation that he actually was floating that? Where is the audio? Where is the tweet? Where is the administration official that will back that up?
It was some good reporting by Axios, and they're pretty well plugged in.
As he says, what's that? So maybe he did, maybe he didn't say that. I enjoyed the conversations about that. Not for whether or not he said it, but I was like, oh.
I heard
can you bomb a hurricane? I want to know.
There was a tragic accident where he accidentally nuked Greenland and bought the hurricane.
I had my producer, Elif, my poor producer, my long-suffering producer, Elif, call the Argonne National Laboratory, the University of Chicago, who are our nuke people in the city, and go, okay. And she said they laughed at her on the phone. But NOAA, she reached out to the, what's that acronym for? NOAA?
Oceanographic Administration.
Atmospheric Administration.
Yeah.
She contacted them and they said, we have an FAQ on this. So at least it's come up. And then they talked about how the radiation fallout would be more harmful than the hurricane.
Do you think?
And that you simply cannot generate. They said a hurricane generates something like a nuclear bomb every 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. You know, for however many days it's coming in. So you cannot push back on the thing. One last thing about the president. He wants to hold the next G7, which the United States, I guess, is going to host at Doral. He said they could all have their own little huts, their own little areas out there. Germany will be over there. Serve German food. The brats will go that way.
Like the Olympics.
Yes, exactly. A village. Hey, I don't know. Is that such a preposterous idea?
It's a bad idea. I think it's illegal. It violates the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution. And I can't believe that he would be thinking about doing it. It's a year from now, so it'll be just a few months away from the presidential election. He's talking about inviting Putin to come over.
Yeah.
Even though the Russians would not be part of the G7, he'd still invite Putin over just to be there and shake hands. I'm not sure. Which would reinforce everything that everyone says about how he cozies up to dictators. I can't imagine what it must be like to work in that guy's office and just be smacking your forehead all the time. And this is such a bad idea. They've had, I think, two of the last three G7, G8s at Camp David, which makes the most sense. It doesn't get this whole business with Trump's business being mixed in with his political role.
I agree with you. Yeah, I don't think he's... There hasn't been any kind of... There's obviously one-on-one meetings or whatever in Trump Tower and things like this, but there's never been, you know, an Olympic Village of foreign dignitaries at a Trump property before. And I do doubt that will happen for the constitutional reasons that Eric mentioned.
For the constitutional reasons.
Or the legal reasons.
Well, the whole thing, I think that they're going to think the better of it. In the run-up to the election, it's a really bad look. And yeah, Trump can make some money for his failing country club down there, but it's just going to be such a bad look that I think his political advisors will really, really push back hard on it. And he'll come up with some reason why it won't work.
Eric, you had an interesting piece in the Tribune today, in fact. Tell us a little bit about that.
It turns out, according to reporting in the New York Times, that there's a group of conservative activists who are associated with the White House in some unclear way are going through the social media feeds of prominent journalists and at media outlets they consider to be critical of Trump, and they're looking for embarrassing material. And the people in the New York Times are really upset because one of their Washington editors got busted for some things he tweeted like 10 years ago that were like Happy Jew Year, I think was one of them. Things that he thought was edgy humor, but was actually...
He was in his early 20s, and he said now it was a lame attempt at edgy humor.
Yeah, and so they're finding these and producing them to embarrass these news organizations. And my thought is, you know, that's fair. That is fair. When you have this public record that you have as an individual and it's out there, and we do the same thing all the time to celebrities, to sports figures, to elected officials, to appointed officials, we do it all the time. We look through their entire lives, and for us to say, well, but you can't look through our life, that doesn't fly as far as I'm concerned, and I'm, you know, potential victim of it, although I've led a pure and blameless life, so I'm not concerned. But
there is a line there, right, though, on who is doing the searching. Because when we talk about, for instance, when it was revealed that the Chicago Police Department was, you know, pulling records on people who would testify at or who would come up to the microphone at those FOP meetings or police accountability meetings, there was rightfully outcry about that. And maybe that's because that's a private database that maybe the public could not have otherwise access that they were using.
Yeah, and it's also kind of creepy. Why would the police be doing that? I mean, I think they're pretty open about why they're doing it. They want to embarrass news, or they want to show that news organizations are have people working for them who are flawed and perhaps hypocritical and so on. So I mean, it's like I don't like it, but I can't think of. Of course, you know, no one wants to have their history plowed into like that. But okay, I can't say that there's a principled reason to be opposed to it.
There's a network then of people that are looking at journalists who are critical of the president, and they're looking for embarrassing things that these people have said digitally over the course of their digital lives, and then they're exposing it. In the case of this one guy at the New York Times, he got demoted from what editor to assistant editor to something else. And you said that's fair, but you also in your column said there should be maybe a statute of limitations. You should only be able to go back so far, or that at some point those things should lapse.
Well,
right?
I think that news organizations need to establish that when they hire people, that they need to set standards for themselves. Like we are going to look at your social media history, and if something and we're going to set a time limit and say if something happened, if you tweeted something out 5 years ago, or maybe set an age limit and say if you tweeted this out at this point, we're not going to pay any, you know, that's water under the bridge. We will stand by you on that. We will put out a statement saying it was
okay.
Youthful indiscretion.
Right. But you didn't extend that. I was waiting for you in the column to then say, should we do that for Supreme Court justice?
Nominees? Well, I had that thought well after I filed the column, which should I have extended that and said, let's.
What would you say about that?
Well, I think for some things, yes. And I wrote when Governor Northam of Virginia, when they found in his old yearbooks that he may have been dressed up in blackface, or he did admit to dressing in blackface.
He couldn't remember if he had the hood on or the blackface, who can't relate.
He was, yeah. Right.
That was something that happened in the early 80s, I think, and I thought, you know, okay, that's there, but I don't think that means that he has to quit.
But Justice Kavanaugh, speak specifically about him. Should we have then given him a pass for the lunacy and idiocy and meanness of his youth?
I think yes. I think that when you have something, an offense, Kavanaugh, of that vintage, that it is something you can say, well, he was 17, something like that. That was what he was alleged to have done was awful. He was 17. That was a very long time ago. What I thought was compounding this was I thought he was lying about it, and I thought that compounded the offense. That was a fresh offense. Yeah, lying about it today,
that's a good point.
Under oath is a fresh offense to deal with.
And I get that.
And so you can say, okay, I would, and I wrote that, so I would give the guy a pass on what he did as a high school student. I don't give him a pass if he's lying about it under oath.
So if he had said at those hearings, yes, those things in the yearbook, we did.
Well, the Renata alumni, whatever
right.
it was.
Yeah. Yeah, right. We were all friends. And there were some other things that he asked us to reinterpret.
I thought those were lies. I thought he was lying under oath about
that. I know that. But if he had copped to that at the hearing, yes, we said and did all those things, you would have been of a mind to say, oh, well, he's being honest about that. And it was young, so let's let him be a Supreme Court justice.
I'm monopolizing this conversation here, but I would say that it does, that what he did at that age, if he's remorseful about it, admits to it, apologizes to it, is not relevant to whether he's qualified to be a Supreme Court justice.
I thought he was qualified to be a Supreme Court justice. He was lying about his youth.
If he's lying under oath in front of Congress, then he's not qualified.
Okay, but I understand that.
But I think you understand.
But go back to the other point that had he admitted to all of those.
Yes.
Things, you would have championed his cause.
Championed? No, I would have said that's not relevant to the question of whether he should be confirmed.
So you didn't think he was qualified to begin
with? No, he's qualified.
Okay,
he's
so
totally
then just
qualified.
Then say that, yes, he should have, you would have affirmed his nomination.
No, I don't like his jurisprudence. But that has nothing to do with what he did in high school.
I'm curious what the rest of the panel thinks about just cancel culture at large. I do think that a pendulum has started to swing the other way. This is a Chappelle special, fresh in my mind, honestly. But Kevin Hart, you saw the same thing. He's back on top of the comedic world after being ousted from the Oscars. With Kavanaugh, I don't know. This is the first time I've heard someone talk about Kavanaugh since the confirmation. And honestly, with this Brett Stevens thing,
Brett Stevens is the bedbug guy?
Bedbugs, Mr. Bedbug. And you have hordes of disaffected people on the internet with nothing better to do than to dig through people's tweets from 10 years ago and dig through public records and dig through all of this stuff. And this has been going on since the advent of the internet. And now I think we're here saying, I don't know if this is a good cultural phenomenon to begin with. I'm curious what other people think.
You mean mining people's digital past?
Saying that if you tweeted something or said something or did whatever 20, 30 years ago, that you should be gone.
Hey, from public discourse.
I'm sorry, I just popped that. I agree with that. I don't know if that applies to Kavanaugh, because the whole Kavanaugh thing came up because he apparently allegedly sexually assaulted.
Yes,
a,
I think
a
the
young
actions,
girl.
And I think that is a bit of a separate
right.
issue. But I do think, in terms of, you know, like someone like Brett Stevens saying, after the right has railed against censorship at college campuses, for instance, that he goes and because of a tweet that someone called him a bedbug, CCs this guy's provost. And says, hey, you should, you know, come to my house and call me a bedbug. He's doing the same sort of nanny state type of stuff that he's, I think, rightfully criticizing at college campuses. And I think that's part of why it blew up.
If we do the lie of the week, maybe we should do the pettiest thing of the week, because this is the pettiest thing of the week. That original tweet wasn't tweeted at him, and it had like 19 likes and no retweets. It was just out there.
Well, and in further context, there was a revelation that, I guess, in some of the break rooms at the New York Times, there were bedbugs. Right? This is the news story behind this. And so this professor tweets out something like, you know, Brett Stevens is the bedbug.
And he's a columnist.
Which isn't even a good joke.
He didn't at the guy. He didn't like flag him.
No.
And it went out to, like you said, a very small number of people liked it and maybe retweeted it. And it's just, and as Austin said, it's a stupid joke.
So then
joke
he tweeted
funny.
It out and at him and said, okay, come to my house. And
he emailed him privately, is my understanding.
That's right.
He emails the guy and says, how dare you, sir, call me a bit of a, come to my house, sir.
Say that in front of my wife and children, I dare you, and I will treat you with civility.
Slapped a glove down on the table.
And that's when it went public then, really. That's when it sort of blew up.
Oh, correct.
That guy shared that.
Correct. And I think it's also a problem. It's just like, it's a mental health thing, right? Like, as soon as you start writing in the public eye, especially if you're doing opinion columns, which Eric knows best here.
I love his columns.
Me too. I love those columns.
You are really a handsome man.
and Brett Stevens is doing this on the biggest national stage for opinion. And yet he is clearly in a position in his life where he's affected by the things that people say about him.
Kind of columnist
that's
is
sad.
Brett Stevens? I don't even know this.
He's a conservative columnist for the New York Times.
You've talked about him. He's the conservative who went to the New York Times. And it was a huge outcry then. People were all over the how to dare the New York Times hire this conservative guy.
He's a never-Trumper, though. He's not.
He's a conservative.
And I mean, in this line of work, I'm sure you guys get it too. You get, you know, people call you names and they send terrible things like email. And they post things like, and you just
mostly I just get it from John.
And I don't get it at all. So it's not me, but it is a problem
just
for other people.
You can't. You have to ignore it. And you can't be punching down like that.
Austin Berg, Steve Bertrand, Eric Zorn. Thanks for joining us today. I'm John Williams. We're produced by Elif Garris. We'll drop another podcast on you next week.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNradio.com. Plus, catch highlights every Saturday from 11 to 11:30 a.m. on The John Williams Show on WGN Radio.